Welcome to The Wagon, presented by Sport Clips, the official podcast of the Canadian Football League.
Welcome, welcome, welcome once again to the Waggle Podcast. And as you know by now, this and every Waggle Podcast is brought to you by our friends at Sport Clips, who are known for their Sport Clips MVP haircut experience, which includes shampoos massaged into your scalp, hot steam towels for your beautiful face, and sports on TV like, for example, hockey, baseball, basketball, but most importantly, everybody's favorite sport, football. And legendary haircuts, of course. It's good to be a guy. It is very good to be a Sport Clips guy. And it's very good to be hosting this podcast because I get to talk to a group of guys that I really, really want to admire. Some I've grown to know very well and really like, but also ones that I really, really enjoyed watching play football. And we've talked to some groups of receivers on this very podcast recently. If you missed those ones, go back through the feed on the Waggle on wherever you get your podcasts and listen to us talk to the flashy receivers from the Winnipeg Blue Bombers or the Calgary Stampeders. But this is a group that wasn't as flashy, but definitely made a similar impact. The Great Canadian Air Force, the group of Saskatchewan Rough Rider receivers that were all together in 2009, that all just happened to be Canadian, all happened to have the same passport. You know who I'm talking about, the local guys, Jason Claremont and Chris Getzlaff. And then the guys who dominated out east, dominated in the OUA for rival schools, Western and Queens. Former teammate of mine, Andy Fantuz, and Rob Bagg, star receiver at Queens, all came together and starred together. And so I wanted to go back in memory lane, and it's making me feel old just thinking about that it was over a decade ago now, to talk about what it was like being a Canadian receiver at that time and maybe how they've been able to pay it forward and the fact that we see so many prolific, not just individual receivers, but receiver groups across the country in the CFL is due to what they were able to do in that short period of time when they were together. Coming up next on The Waggle, Andy Fantuz, Rob Bagg, Chris Getzlaff, and Jason Claremont, the Canadian Air Force. So guys, and first and foremost, thanks for making the time to join me. The CFL, when you think about it and think about the lore of the league, there's great nicknames, whether it's Pinball or Gizmo for specific players. But you guys were a group of players that had a great nickname, the Canadian Air Force. You guys playing together in 2009, how and when did that nickname come about? Do you remember?
2009, I guess, is when we had the four of us there that were all, in the lineup and making plays on a consistent basis. And then you add in Dressler was the honorary Canadian. And it just seemed like we had a revolving door of people making plays. And Durant had a lot of options. And I can't remember how it came to be, but it stuck on pretty fast and kind of went viral across the league. So, I mean, especially in Saskatchewan and with the fan base there, but it was a pretty cool, I thought it was a pretty cool name that I was proud of. And, it was nice to see us like really taking the league by storm and having a bunch of, your best buds. And that was a lot of fun.
Jason, you were the veteran of the group and you had already, established yourself as a dominant player in the league at that point. What was it like, to have a bunch of young guys who were trying to, replicate the career that you were having?
Well, I think that on that Canadian Air Force, by that time, I was the guy with the old prop propeller just being air traffic control, and these other guys were the new jet engines that I was kind of just clearing the runway for, to be honest.
What did the young guys learn from being able to see him up close and see him kind of practice and prepare every day?
I mean, I think you got to see firsthand the kind of work ethic a guy like that has in the toughness, both mentally and physically, and just coming in and, he made one of the biggest plays of that year in the playoffs, which was that was one of the funnest celebrations that I had that whole year, was celebrating that overtime touchdown.
For sure. And then just as another guy, kind of like Getty, where it was you know, I think that, well, 09 was my second year in the league, but having grown up watching, not grown up, but in university watching Jason make all those plays out west and kind of really looking up to him. And same with Fantuz being a couple years ahead of me, watching him make plays at Western. I don't want to say I was riding the coattails, but I certainly just enjoyed being associated with those two guys and learned a ton through that year, just their work habits and the way they approached every day. And really just 9 and 10, the first thing that I think about is just how much fun we had that season. It was, it seemed to be a, you know, a splash in the pan in terms of the amount of time that we played, we all played in the league, but it was definitely two of the more memorable seasons, even though they ended, you know, in the worst kind of way where you didn't reach your goal and become champions. It was just, every day was fun coming to work there. And every day I learned something being around that group.
I love that you mentioned, you know, your university time, Rob, because, you know, Chris, Rob, Andy, you guys are not that far away in age. And so you would have competed against each other, you know, for all Canadian awards and just, you know, being considered high in your draft class. And, you know, often when there's a lot of guys around the same age, there's competition for roster spots and for opportunity. But it didn't seem like there was that animosity between the group. Why?
I'll answer first, Getz. I don't know if it was just a guy that had lack of technology, but I feel like the world's just gotten a lot closer too. Like I would see stat lines, of course, from, you know, the Can West there, and obviously saw what guys like Bauman and Getty were doing out west. But at the same time, it wasn't like film was being passed around that readily. So you just saw numbers, and it just wasn't that personal. Frankly, I got the opportunity to meet those guys at the Combine, Getz, if you remember, down in Toronto.
Absolutely.
But again, it was just such a quick occurrence. Like you saw the guys, you saw how good they were over the course of a 2 week period. But I just feel like over the course of my career, like the CFL Combine and just the Canadian content as a whole has come a long way, that we kind of blur the lines in terms of where it was just, you know, roughly 20 years ago or 15 years ago. Like there wasn't a whole lot I felt like went into it at the time. It was just all of a sudden, you went from being a college player to a CFL player. At least that's the way it was for me. So I definitely watched a lot more film of Andy, just because he was in the OUA and a guy that I watched, you know, both firsthand and in the film room. So that was kind of my experience. I don't know if yours was totally different, Getty, but I really didn't appreciate how good those guys were until I met them, and that was at the Combine and then in training camps in years to come.
Yeah, I would say mine is very similar. I mean, other than the overall stat line, like, you know, I just didn't know anything about these guys that were out east or anything, right? So, I mean, the first time that you're going to get to meet them and really not spend hardly any time whatsoever together was at the Combine. I mean, you're just out there competing on the field or on the field doing your drills and, you know, trying to put up some numbers to get drafted. But it wasn't until you're actually in a training camp with these guys that you really get to know them. You really get to know why they were successful in college and why they're going to be successful in the CFL. So, I mean, it becomes a lot more personal once you're actually in the same locker room with someone and seeing them on a day-to-day basis and understanding not only their play on the field, but their study habits and how they practice.
The thing I love about you guys and looking at your career trajectories is just how the perception of a Canadian receiver has changed over the year. You know, Claremont, when you were coming into the league, you know, Canadian receiver was thought of like the fifth wide receiver, wide, just run for exercise. And you changed that perception by being someone who dominated in the slot and won based off of moving around with matchups. And then by the time all you guys are in the league, the success you all had, teams started to think, well, we need depth at this position. We need a bunch of Canadian guys that can make plays. Now when you guys watch the game, and I'll ask you first, Andy, do you notice how featured Canadians are both in the draft process, but even, you know, week to week in terms of scheme?
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head there. When I was coming through college in my early years, I was really studying and admiring a guy like JC when he was in BC and really trying to model a lot of my game after him and learn tips and techniques from him. But there was only, you know, there's guys like Cahoon and a couple others across the league. But, yeah, it's a lot different now where you're seeing, You're seeing Canadian receivers make the all-star team, you know, league-wide, considered the top receivers on the team or in the league. And it is very important to have that depth on your team. So, and you're probably right that maybe that Rough Rider team in 2009, 2010 kind of paved that way of, oh, maybe we can have two or three starting Canadian receivers, and that could be a successful like recipe for a championship.
Jason, when you were coming into the league, you know, the perception was, you know, an American receiver had to prove that he couldn't play, and a Canadian receiver had to prove that he could play. Did you feel that? Did you feel like, you know, you had to prove that you could be, you know, number one in the route tree and progression, and someone who could be counted on to make big plays?
Yeah, and it took a little time. I know that when I started in BC, we went 1-5, and I was kind of a tight end, special teams guy, you know, came into some packages on offense, made some plays here and there. But by the time we were 1-5 and did a coaching change, at that point, I got to move into the slot. And that was the time that, you know, for 7 years, I just was fighting tooth and nail to make sure that the guys whose names were written behind me in the depth chart weren't going to jump ahead of me. Obviously, I did fairly well in that when I was in BC. And when I came to Saskatchewan, it was a bit of a different offense. It was kind of more of a run and shoot offense. You know, I'm coming from a role where I was kind of a bruising slot back. And I've always been able to supplant guys. Effort was always my edge. I was always able to outwork guys, no matter how much more talented they were than me. And then I came in to a group with, you know, guys like Getz and Dress and Twos and Bagger. And these guys were not only talented, but, you know, you weren't going to outwork them. So that was, I think that was the big thing, was with that team, that 09 and 2010 team, having that group of guys who were talented, but also just worked together so well and had such a high work ethic that they couldn't be beat.
When you think of receiver, the position in general and groups, like there's some words we use to talk about them, right? Divas and flashy. You guys weren't like that. In many ways, you kind of were like more like hockey players and rugby players than you were theoretical, you know, football receivers. Why is that the case?
I'll answer that one. I think, and I feel like I can't answer that question because I did play Z primarily throughout my career. But it just, I think it just reflects the group. You know, it kind of gives me goosebumps, and also I'm flattered to hear that Claremont recognized the fact that we were out there working hard. I know, again, as a younger guy, whether I consciously acknowledge it or not, I really just wanted to be respected by my peer group there, the receiver room, first and foremost, particularly early on in my career. I definitely remember volunteering, and I definitely took a lot of pride in, you know, whether it was a bubble screen or just run blocking down the field. I didn't want to be the guy that let down the room. I didn't want to be the guy that was, you know, that we all looked at film and saw that maybe you could have run a little harder. Maybe you could have finished the play better. It could have created a 10-yard play into a 50-yard play if you just did your job. And, you know, again, as a young guy in there and having such high respect and regard for the older players like JC, as well as the young guys, you know, I just felt like there was a onus in the group that everyone kind of shared to make sure you did your part. And you knew that if you blocked hard on this particular play, you'd be rewarded in the future with either a block down the line or just a play call, frankly, from Coach LaPolice. I felt like that was the offense where you had an opportunity to earn your production. If you did the stuff that isn't necessarily glorified, like the run blocking, you'd get a chance to, you know, you'd be the guy that gets the pump and go on the bubble screen when that play's set up. So I always appreciated that. And frankly, I just took a lot of pride in, and I think everyone in the group did, in just terms of doing the dirty work, if you will. So you just made those tasks fun. And that's how I remember those years.
You mentioned LaPolice, and I don't think it's a coincidence. You guys got an opportunity, a big one, you know, from someone who's tied to the Canadian game. Andy, what made him, you know, so successful as a, you know, an offensive mind and play caller?
I think he really just had a lot of fun coming to practice and scheming up plays, and he also was really good at taking input from his players. Like he certainly knew what he wanted to accomplish, and he was willing to let us kind of give our two cents about little tweaks and that we could make the play better or ideas. But he knew how to have us all play really hard. Like Rob said, I think he hit it right on the nail where he wanted to share the wealth. He thought we'd be a more successful team if teams couldn't defend a certain player or a certain couple players. And we just had that culture instilled from him, and it kind of just trickled down the line, like LaPolice to the quarterbacks and then through the receiver room, where it was really a win by committee, and there was no animosity or egos in that room. It was all about, where someone's going to make a play this time and someone else the next time. And as long as we're winning and having fun, and I think it was just that, like, that contagious sort of culture that he instilled in us that really made it fun to play for him and made us successful.
Chris.
Yeah, I'll just add something to that as well. When it comes to Lapo, you know, every single week, no matter what year you're talking, your offensive coordinator is trying to put in, you know, a handful of plays that are specifically designed to beat certain coverages that are tendencies that the other opponent is going to bring to you that given week. And I would say throughout the course of my career, no one put in more successful plays than Lapo. I felt like he practiced them against what we were going to expect, and almost always it was successful in the game, getting the exact coverage that he was expecting. So I thought he did a really good job when it came to, you know, those handful of plays that were specifically designed a lot of times in the red zone, to be successful on any given week. So, you know, playing with the group of guys that we did, it just allowed us to move around within that offense and help create successful situations for everybody. And Lapo did a really good job of both preparation and getting guys involved.
So there's that aspect of coaching, but there's a lot of guys who can do that and be an assistant and number two. And then when you're leading from the head of the room as a head coach, it's a bit different. Jason, you've had the opportunity to play for you know, great leaders, and probably Wally is, you know, considered legendary. Now that Lapo is trying to become a head coach and transfer that success, you know, are there specific traits that he has that you think are going to lend themselves to being a good head coach?
Well, I think, you know, Chris kind of hit the nail on the head with his preparation and understanding the strength of his personnel. And he did that on offense better than anybody. He was able to understand the arc of a great offensive game plan and was able to figure out how to paint that picture throughout the course of a game, so the defense didn't know when we were going to try to hit some of these big plays with our athletes that they should have known we're going to try to hit big plays with. So I think that, you know, for him to transition from being that offensive focused kind of guru into commanding the entire room, that's not something you can, you know, snap your fingers and do overnight. And he's had a bit of a transition to be able to do that. And I think that where he is now, as opposed to where he was when he was first given the opportunity as a head coach, he's light years ahead. And that's just a testament to him being able to adapt and evolve, you know, much like his offensive game plans were from week to week. He's been able to adapt and evolve his leadership to encompass that whole room.
So let's go through the list. If we were building the perfect receiver throughout this group, and we had to pick attributes of all your games, whose hands would we want? Who's got the best hands?
I feel like you got a good group here, but I mean, between I know he's not me included on this call here, but I feel like Dress is, as Tu's mentioned, an honorary Canadian. I feel like when we discuss the Canadian Air Force, we'd be amiss if we didn't mention him, because he was certainly thrown into the group at his dismay a number of times. But I mean, obviously Fantuz, and I think Fantuz and Claremont, like, I don't really, I have a hard time envisioning any balls hitting the floor that were directed their way. But you know, Dress is right there as well. So, for a guy that had fingers the size of a very small man, I think Dress is incredibly a good pass catcher. And then obviously JC there. I think if you're just going to go Madden style and create a guy, you're probably picking their mitts and their ability and their range. So that'd be my vote.
Agreed.
Okay, so who are we going with in terms of speed?
I think Bag was probably the fastest out of all of us.
As a group, maybe, yeah. I think I was, I didn't know how to slow down. So I was just always in fifth gear, even if my fifth gear wasn't as fast as maybe somebody else would have liked. I just couldn't really pull the throttle back. So, I think I would be sufficient, but I think there was probably some other people out there that you'd want to pull from first.
I think the thing with us is that we all had incredible waggles. So no yeah. matter what our time speed was, when that ball was snapped, we could all, I mean, Robbie often would be on the line, but like you said, he's immediately into fifth gear and we were just flying downfield. So very hard to defend when you got a bunch of big guys running at you full speed. So that was one thing that we had an advantage over the rest of the league, that's for sure.
Okay, well, let's parlay that. And after the Waggle, who's the best route runner?
Depends on the route.
Yeah, I'm gonna tell Getty.
I'm gonna give that corner out to Get for sure. Get yeah. for sure.
Well, yeah,
and then, I mean, if we're running that inside crosser, it depends. You want to take Fantuz, who's going to turn you sideways, or do you want Clermont, who is going to take a shade and then just put you flat backed at the 6 yard line? So, I mean, I think it's an understatement here, but I think our greatest strength as a group was that we brought a little bit of everything to the table, but did it at full speed and repeatedly. So I don't know if there's any of us that maybe are your prototypical player in any particular way, but I think it was just the way we attacked the game and that particular game plan that made us so dangerous.
Okay, and lastly, and this is one I wouldn't ask most receiver groups, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask it to you guys because it was a big reason why you were successful. Who's the best blocker?
I was going to say Clermont. JC. I mean, JC will light you up, yeah.
I don't know about that.
I don't think many people put guys on their back like JC did. Sorry to cut you off, JC.
These guys aren't giving themselves enough credit as far as downfield blocking was concerned and you know, hustling to make a play all the way down the field. Every single one of these guys I would have had in front of me. Every single one of these guys are that guy you wanted for that, you know, hitch screen that they're going to keep working all the way until the play is done. So I think if you could distribute one of these guys to every team in the CFL, that would be their best blocker.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably the only group of receivers that could count pancake blocks the way offensive linemen could. So, I mean, I think that just shows the way you guys all played the game. And lastly, and I'll just leave this up to all you guys to chime in, what's the best story you guys have about playing with each other and what that time in your careers was like?
Well, when you said that earlier to Getz, I had one memory kind of pop into my head, but it wasn't specifically about this group. It was the one game that I think it was against Edmonton, or it was against Edmonton, I know that for sure, but that we had the thunder delay and we had about an hour and a half break and then we came back in the pouring rain and there were a bunch of fans with their jerseys off in the stands and we came back from, I think, 10 down with like 8 minutes to go in the fourth quarter and won that game. And that was one of the most fun kind of finishes I had. The other good one actually was 2010, the first game of the year, Canada Day against Montreal. It went into like double overtime. And I remember, well, I mean, there were so many sweet plays that game, but the thing I remember the most, or that really is unique to me, is the Canadian anthem. We had the Jets fly by, and then the anthem was going on, and like the Canadian geese flew diagonally across the stadium, like right during the anthem, and it was like the most beautiful day, and it just it's giving me chills right now just thinking about it, to be honest.
Yeah, that was
an awesome day. Retro jerseys on with those red helmets. That was a lot of fun. It was a shootout all the way to the end.
Yeah, man. Yeah, there were so many games and just moments, and some of them all blur together. But you know, at the time, I don't recall other teams having the same opportunities necessarily that we did as a franchise. But like when Tuzas cereal came out, you know, I remember that going down into the, would it be the north end zone there, Fantuz? But just like, just things that, you know, again, having the only places I really played football were at Queens and then with the Riders. And I feel like I broke my largest crowd barrier with the Riders in training camp in Saskatoon at the green and white game. So it was, everything was just bigger and more exciting out west. And certainly, again, as a guy that, all my own fault, but had very little idea of just the culture in Western Canada, how important football was to that province. As a guy that was coming from Kingston, Ontario, everything was just eye-opening and in a great way. Like it was really fun for what you did on the football field to matter so much to the community, and then to be surrounded by like-minded individuals that also took pride, but also really had fun coming to work every day. I think it was top down. I think Ken Miller really established a culture that was family driven. And then I think he had great assistants that not only bought in, but had a really good, or really were effective at kind of passing that down through the ranks. So yeah, specifically those years where the Canadian Air Force or this group of guys were on the team, every day was fun, and frankly, the 6 months just flew by. I wasn't ready to come home when it all ended.
Yes. So the first game that came to mind was that one that you were talking about in 2010, twos against Montreal. The season opener was an outstanding game. But I'll just go aside from football and say my experiences kind of with each of them that were outside of the actual gameplay. I mean, JC, I got an opportunity. I grew up in Regina, so I got to kind of follow in his footsteps at a lot of the teams he played. He played for the Rams, which I ended up playing for. He played for the Rams while they were junior team, and the university team, which I played for the junior team, the Thunder for myself, and then the Rams in university, and then got to follow into the CFL. But having the opportunity to room with him on the road for his time in Saskatchewan was awesome. You know, get to hang out outside of the field doing that. And then with Andy, the Hearts games, we were talking about it kind of when you were off the air there for a minute, but the Hearts games on the road, on the plane or on the bus, just hammering out Hearts Cards games. And then Bagger lived with me for a period of time, and we played a lot of golf. So we got, you know, had different experiences with different guys and just shared a lot of time outside of the actual practice or game day experience, which, you know, those are the moments you truly treasure.
Well, I appreciate you guys sharing those moments with us, you know, not just Rider fans, but CFL fans, you know, across the country are really obviously kind of missing, you know, seeing, you know, football on the field and nostalgic for the memories that you guys gave us on the field and the way you led in the communities off the field. So thank you for bringing us back in that period of time. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
So that was the 09 Riders. But let's turn the hands of time back a little bit farther. And let's talk about the 07 Riders, the team Andy Fantuz was on. Jamie Nye, who's covered basically all of the Rider teams since then, he's going to join us to talk about what that team was like in 07. That and more after this.
For 107 years, every Grey Cup moment has included you, the fan. This is your league. Through fog and rain, in tragedy and triumph, you are the foundation of this league. Now take your place in history. For a limited time, you can etch your name on the Grey Cup fan base. Become a part of the Grey Cup's legacy. Visit greycupfanbase.ca to add your name and raise the cup.
Hey guys and girls, Waggle listeners near and far, you probably already know this, but in case you don't, Athabasca University, Canada's online university, turned 50 this year. And they want to celebrate by giving away a CFL workspace makeover to you. Yes, you. The prize includes $3,500 in gift cards for workspace upgrades, plus exclusive CFL merchandise to deck out that very space. All you have to do is enter right now at cfl.ca/AU Workspace Makeover. That's cfl.ca/AU Workspace Makeover. So by now you know that the CFL and the Kubota have teamed up for remote reunions. You can go to cfl.ca and see full episodes of great teams getting back together, like we all are right now, virtually, and from different locations, and you know, talking and sharing a laugh and stories, whether it's the 2009 Montreal Alouettes or the 1998 Calgary Stampeders, the 99 Hamilton Tiger Cats, some great, great teams, great individuals that have a big part of our game are all getting together, and that is all brought to you by Kubota. And so what we've done here on the WAGO is we've revisited some of those great conversations, some of those great teams. And so our remote reunion driven by Kubota is about the 07 Riders. And no one better to talk to us about the 07 Riders than a guy who's covered the Riders in 07. He's still covering them now and doing a great job. And that's Jamie Nye. And Jamie, let's talk about a Rider team that is still referenced, is still beloved, and is a reference point in many ways on how teams have been built since the 07 Saskatchewan Rough Riders, a team that obviously brought the cup back home to Saskatchewan. When you think of that team, what comes to mind?
Well, I think of the new era that happened in 2007, because you think back and it was the Danny Barrett, Roy Shivers Riders from the year 2000 until 06, and it was clear they were 9-9. They were 9-9. They had 11 wins, and they had 9 wins, and it was they couldn't get over the hump. So when I think of 2007, I think of Eric Tillman came in halfway through the year before, and then Danny Barrett got fired at the end of the season when, again, they failed in their West final against the BC Lions, and in come to Kent Austin, and it just seemed like a fresh start. Eric Tillman brought in a bunch of new faces, Lance Frazier. You saw Anton McKenzie move in. You saw, you know, Andy Fantuz was drafted previously, but he took a jump in his career. John Chick came in, and it just seemed like it was a fresh start, or just pressed the refresh on a team that was there. They were good, but they just couldn't get over the hump.
It's funny you mentioned that, because that's the other thing that stuck out to me is Eric Tillman and the way he built the team, the way he valued Canadians and didn't see them as, you know, a default that you had to start an X amount. He really invested in, you know, his draft processes and then invested in trying to keep them and paying them. Are there lessons, you know, that the league learned about how that team was built that we now see in the Canadian game?
Well, what you see is a load of great Canadians, and a lot of them were holdovers. Like I said, Fantuz was drafted previously to Eric Tillman, but, you know, Scott Schultz in the middle, that offensive line had 4 starters who were Canadian, thanks to, you know, Gene Mikowski, who's the ratio breaker as the longtime left tackle. And you started to see that they could put Mike McCullough on the field, and you could put different Canadians in different spots and use a rotation. And it was just that I think a lot of teams know that, but it's interesting when more teams commit to it. We've seen the Calgary Stampeders commit to it. When the Riders became successful in 2013 again, they committed to it. You always look at the Grey Cup champion and you see that Canadian talent, that Canadian depth is always there. And they needed it. Like Michael Palmer started in that Grey Cup game as a Canadian receiver because of injuries that just occurred that season, and their depth was tested a lot that year. So, and it's an testament to, you know, Eric Tillman, but also credit to Roy Shivers, the GM previously put a lot of that depth already in place that Eric just added to.
So at the time they end the longest drought that was going in terms of time without winning a Grey Cup for a franchise, they beat, you know, the team in Winnipeg that recently ended a long drought of their own. What did it mean locally to bring back the third Grey Cup championship to Ryderville?
Well, I remember that season was lit up. of course, for Saskatchewan Rough Rider fans. You look at the Labor Day game, Kerry Joseph, one of the most legendary moments for a Labor Day game when he runs it in on the draw. That was 2007. Before that, the lights went out. There's a storm. Fans were sent home, and they win that game, right? They came back and won after the rain delay, and half the stadium was in, but it sounded like there was 50,000 people there. And it just seemed finally, after so many things would just, you know, Rider Nation was like, what's going to go wrong this time? It seemed like everything was going right in 2007. So you go to the playoff game, 2007 West semifinal, the first home playoff game since 1988, 19 years they waited to have a home playoff game. And that stadium was berserk. You couldn't hear a thing. And then DJ Flick opens the scoring, Kerry Joseph over the top on a big play. And it just seemed like nothing was going to stop them. They roll into BC where they'd lost the West Final previously and roll on through to the Grey Cup. And if you're in Toronto Grey Cup week, it seemed like it was the Grey Cup in Saskatchewan because there was a whole lot of green. And it was just that, hey, these lovable losers are finally winners again.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a time when, you know, the Vanier Cup and the Grey Cup were together on the same weekend in the same building. And the Vanier Cup, you know, a little bit prior, was full of green for teams that weren't from Saskatchewan. The entire city of Toronto was green that weekend, and for good reason. When I look at that team, you know, obviously Ken Austin, at the start of his, you know, coaching career, he goes on to have, you know, success continued there, but also elsewhere in football, and went on to be executive for a little bit. But when I look at that team in the depth chart, it's not lost on me that the all-star center of that team is Jeremy O'Day, now leading the Riders. When you look at the type of way he's built his team and the structure, do you see any through lines to the time that he spent playing on that team and the success that they had in 07?
Well, I think what Jeremy, and, you know, I'll reference the reunion that you guys did with them, looking back with his teammates, what Jeremy referenced in that show was interesting, was the locker room and the camaraderie in the locker room. And there were no divides in that locker room. And I'll be honest, covering this team under the Chris Jones era, it was clear that there were divides in the locker room. There was offense, there was defense. Naaman Roosevelt told me just that in an interview. He said the offense this year, when it was Craig Dickinson and Jeremy O'Day as the head coach, general manager, feel like we're part of it, where Chris Jones was, you know, it was a lot of defense first. He was flipping players from offense over to defense because he liked the athletes. And that's what I think Jeremy O'Day really looks at, is character in the individuals and how are they going to fit in the locker room. And is this locker room healthy? Is this a united front from all three phases? And that's what's going to get the job done, because he referenced it in the reunion show. And I thought that tells you how he wants a championship team to be modeled, is a bunch of guys, you know, the 45 that play, the 46 that play, but the 60 guys that are in there are all in it together.
And lastly, let's talk about football locally right now. What are you hearing for your listeners? What are you seeing in terms of your mentions when you're talking to fans in the audience, 980 CJME or 650 CKOM? The loss of football and the loss of a season and the hopes of football being back, being played locally in 2021. What has that been like for people who set their calendar around the CFL season, like they do in Saskatchewan, to deal with?
Well, I think what I'm hearing is it's frustrating. They want an answer. They want a yes. They want a no. They want to plan their lives again. You know, this is a province that plans their weddings around game day. Like, they look for the calendar to come out, or the schedule to come out, and go, okay, there's no game this weekend. We can get married this weekend because the family won't be going to Regina to watch a football game for the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. So I think it's just more than that. They want their family back. They want to be back with their fans because it's an extended family in the stands. So it's a lot of frustration. I've been surprised how many people have been going, you know, I'm starting to lose hope on what's going on, and that's concerning to me. But hopefully we get an answer soon, because I know when that yes comes, we're playing in 2021, it's going to be a gong show because fans will have something to be excited about.
Well, I'm sure, you know, the phone lines will be lit up for a long, long time talking about, you know, what the team will be like in 2021 as that pent up excitement, you know, continues to build. Always great to chat to you. We will be bothering you to chat about what the Riders will be like in 2021. But in the interim, thank you so much for taking us back down memory lane and talking about another great time in Rider history, 2007.
Yeah, right on. Can't wait till Grey Cup week 2021 in Hammer.
Awesome. Take care. We'll see you there. So thanks so much for listening for a very Rider heavy but very fun episode of The Waggle. Again, thank you to Jamie Nye. Give him a follow on Twitter at Jamie Nye. And if you are in the football capital of Canada, make sure you give him a listen. The Green Zone is 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. on 980 CJME. He's always doing a great job covering this team from all angles. If you want coverage of the CFL from all angles, make sure you go to CFL.ca. We've got some great content on there. And coming up, Grey Cup Unite. You've heard a little bit about it. Well, that content is going to be rolled out on the website in the next coming weeks. And if you want continual coverage of the CFL, make sure you continue to listen to this podcast. But also, it'd be much appreciated if you favorite, give 5 stars, like, share, and if you haven't already, subscribe. Until next time, thanks for listening.
The Waggle, presented by Sportclips, the official podcast of the Canadian Football League.